How can I Habermas you if I can barely Habermas myself? I asked myself that several points while reading this third part of Legitimation Crisis, and hopefully have been able to overcome these deficiencies, have Habermased myself, and maybe Habermas you, listener.
Maybe our listeners can Habermas you, Alex.
Maybe they can Habermas me. It's true. I'm open to being Habermased. I'm Habermasable. Welcome to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of the end of history. This is for you, dearest patrons, inner circle people, the Reading Club. This is the second block of the Reading Club of the year, of which we're doing Legitimation Crisis by Jürgen Habermas. And specifically now we're turning to part three in the last third of the book, which is, well, it's a doozy. It's a doozy. George.
Yeah, it is. So first part, a social scientific concept of crisis. This was quite a lot of theoretical ground clearing. You know, we talked about some of the, I guess, the concepts of crisis that Habermas outlines, all of that kind of background work. I think the second part was where it really kind of got cooking. Crisis tendencies in advanced capitalism, Habermas's model of capitalist society, the different sorts of economic rationality, legitimation and motivation crises in those sorts of societies. And then today, we're on the third part, appropriately, on the logic of legitimation problems. So this, I think there's a lot to talk about in this, there's a lot to think about. And just quickly, I guess, to run through the chapters for listeners, it starts off with Max Weber's concept of legitimation, and then a kind of classical Habermasian prose here, the relation of practical questions to truth. Then he continues the model of the suppression of generalizable interests. Then we have the end of the individual, question mark. That's a good one. Chapter five is then complexity and democracy, and finally, partiality for reason. So as we've experienced in the first two parts, there's a lot in each of those chapters, and consequently an awful lot in even one part of this very dense book, but some really interesting questions and a lot to discuss. So my take on this is that the overarching concern of this part of the book is the relation of legitimation to truth, or to put it in more Habermasian terms, quote, the continued existence of a truth-dependent mode of socialization constitutive of society. So pretty big questions there, truth and legitimation, essentially. So, okay, great. I think it's fair to say this part moves back to the more theoretical and abstract questions that we covered in the first part, after the more political content of part two, which focused, as I said, on those kind of crisis tendencies in advanced capitalism, and so gave us some ideas of different sorts of crises, which is always kind of interesting to read and discuss. And so I think it's probably fair to say, for me at least, it felt a little bit less relevant, perhaps less gripping at times than previous parts. Was I alone in this? Was this more tough going than the previous part, or did you guys just breeze through it with intellectual ease and glide on the waves of Habermasian prose, if that mixed metaphors there?
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's ever glided on those waves.
If you're a surfer, you glide on waves.
You do indeed.
An idea surfer.
I don't. Oh my God, that is maybe one of the worst things I've ever heard on a pod. I think I was definitely Habermasted by this section. I don't know if that's kind of just because by virtue of coming to the end of the book, or by the, you know, density. I wouldn't say, you know, it's all, there's some parts of it that are kind of gripping and brilliant. And even the more kind of abstract kind of formulations about the relationship between how kind of practical social questions, how they relate themselves to questions of truth, even when formulated in his incredibly dense kind of sentences, nonetheless, there's something there which is valid and important. And it's, you know, it's hard to see how you could frame a question like that more succinctly either. You know, when you think about it, about, I mean, I'm sure Habermas could write more clearly. I mean, I guess we all could. But also there are some phrases which are just, they just convey difficult ideas, and it's hard to see how they could be done better. One thing that I think would help is probably more examples. So it's not so much the difficulty of the language as the kind of aridity with respect to concrete illustration.
Could you give us an example of a time when he doesn't give an example?
Well, just the one that you mentioned yourself, this where he says this continued existence of a truth-dependent mode of socialization constitutive of society.
Or when he talks about normative structures, right? What is a normative structure?
Yeah, you've got to read that a few times. Yeah, indeed, yeah. You've got to read that a few times to understand what's being said there.
Yeah, I think you're always like teetering on the brink of comprehension and complete, like being completely in the dark, you know? So you're like, you're grabbing on, you know, and you have this idea of like normative institution. Okay, you think you have an idea of what that is, but you're not sure. And you're going along, and then he throws something else in, and then you're a bit like, whoa, I'm trying to hold, you know, keep these plates spinning at the same time without any kind of concreteness. And if you just gave an example, one of these spinning plates would be, you know, firmly attached to the stick, and you could hold on to that confidently and while worrying about the other spinning plates, you know. I think like there's basically like three things that make this really difficult, in my opinion. I think one is the level of abstraction that he's dealing with and that he's working at, which I think to a certain extent there's no getting away from that, and because he's trying to be fairly comprehensive about how society functions, about how social systems function. The other thing is that he's often turning inward to and this is certainly the case in the third part, turning inward to academic debate. So he's dealing with and engaging with systems theory, with particularly the work of Nicholas Luhmann. And you're like, okay, but I don't know the work of Nicholas Luhmann well. I don't know what Habermas's position is with regard to it. And even reading the debate that Habermas sets up between himself and Luhmann, you're still not entirely sure what the stakes
are. Why don't you know the work of Nicholas Luhmann?
Well,
he's a luminary of social theory.
I know, but never really came across it.
You're
a
podcaster. It's your job to be informed about these things.
Systems theory is not really kind of big in the social sciences nowadays. So it's, you know, bear in mind, I came, you know, for me, it was like social constructionism was the hot thing, not systems theory. And, you know, you can say, you can debate the merits and demerits of each and in respect to each other. But anyway. Anyway, the point being is that, you know, in part two, it was juicy because he turns outwards to talk about society. And in part three, it goes back into this debate. So I think like Phil, it's not necessarily like, I don't find it stylistically that difficult. And the sentences, I've read longer sentences, you know, like that there are writers who are more elaborate and certainly more Baroque. It's just that it's very arid. And again, it's like the lack of examples. You're not really ever certain if you know 100% that the image you have in your head corresponds to what Habermas is trying to communicate to you, which is maybe a lesson in communicative ethics. Jürgen, eh?
Very, very good. No, I think there is a strength and a weakness to that, to not giving any examples, which is that if you get on a roll mentally, you can put in your favorite example and you can build something quite interesting in your own head almost. But no, I think, you know, incumbent on us a little to simplify or to kind of grapple with some of the political stakes of this. And one thing which I was thinking about a little bit was, is this all about, like, are we living in a post-truth society? This would be the kind of headline grabbing kind of opinion piece way to put it. I'm not sure Habermas would be the person to write that particular opinion piece, but it's almost like, is the structure by which we legitimate societies today completely independent of truth, which is a, you know, a $10 word saying, are we living in a post-truth society? If we are, then that's kind of, you know, makes things easier for us discussing this book, because we can say anything. We don't have to be right or wrong. But no, that's a bit
I'm not
bit
sure that's what that means.
No, but it's, I mean, that, I think that's kind of what he's driving at, right? The social structures, are they dependent on truth to socialize individuals? Is that how we can constitute society through our interactions,
and it's
or not?
It is a genuinely profound question. I mean, I suppose the reason I flinched...
My question or Habermas's question?
Obviously Habermas's question or yours.
Oh, so close.
The reason listeners won't have obviously seen this, but the reason I flinched when you said post-truth, George, is only because I think, you know, the idea of all that post-truth stuff is limited to the discourse.
Well,
which is to say, it's about kind of understood discourse. As a matter. It's understood as a matter of kind of people's relationship to media. Whereas in this context, you know, he's talking about not about assimilation of information or whether we're assimilated to information or whatever, but rather socialization more broadly conceived, you know, which encompasses kind of social structures, psychological transformation, psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic concepts, as well as political integration, and whether or not any of those processes have a basis in truth. And, you know, so it's just, I suppose it's a bigger, it's not unrelated to those questions of post-truth that we kind of people bat about today, but it's also a bigger kind of vista on them.
Yeah, no, I mean, also post-truth is the way it's discussed, it's personalized, whereas Habermas's concern is very impersonal. So it's about like, you know, today post-truth,
yeah, it's a really
are these claims makers telling the truth? Yeah. Do they have the proper responsibility with regard to truth? You know, are people being suckered by the truth? But it's all about individuals with believing or telling untruths.
It's about management in effect.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of the give, I guess. It's a good point, Alex, because really what, I mean, you know, it will come as no surprise to our listeners that post-truth is obviously kind of politically instrumentalized in fairly obvious and crude ways, whereas Habermas, for all his faults, is trying to kind of grasp at a more kind of systemic structural perspective.
Mm. Yeah, just to maybe wrap this up and move on to the next point, there's a good New Left Review piece by Wolfgang Strake, which we can link to in the show notes, The Return of the Repressed, which is very much on this and kind of, you know, gives some good tidbits like post-factual, and I'll even try and pronounce it in German, post-faktisch was the German word of the year in 2016. And so all of this had a bit of a rebirth around 2016, post-truth in that was an OED nominee for the English word of the year. I mean, we've talked about this sort of stuff quite a lot in 2016. Listeners might be able to infer the political context or think about that themselves. But yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes. Yeah, so to move on to, I guess, how Habermas starts all of this, he starts it with Weber. So, you know, obviously a key thinker on legitimacy, on rationality as well, and his concept of legitimation, Weber's this is, I think comes from, or the way Habermas puts it, and I would, you know, broadly agree with this, that Weber has these three types of authority. So traditional, charismatic, and rational legal. And should probably explain those a little bit, actually, shouldn't I? So charismatic is vested in an individual charismatic leader. Traditional, these are the authority that comes from doing things the way that they've always been done. And then this, like, characteristically modern is essentially rule following rational legal authority. And this becomes, through the dialectic of rationalization, as Weber might put it, accumulated in bureaucracies, which become one of the defining modern institutions in Weber's terms. But anyway, to get back onto how Habermas uses Weber, he says, okay, Weber's concept of rational legal authority is a decisionistic one, similar to Schmitt's legal theory. We've talked about Schmitt on this podcast quite a bit previously, but the idea essentially here is that Weber starts with arbitrary decisions within a legal framework are legitimated. There's no necessary relation to truth grounding them. Have I got this sort of about right? Because I think this is a, you know, it's an important point if Habermas is correct in his reading of Weber, because it's, you know, that's a pretty bold starting point. All of authority is basically grounded in rules. The rules are arbitrary to a greater or lesser extent. And that's how you get your authority. There's no relation to truth there.
He wants them to be, I mean, Habermas wants them to be truthful, obviously, but he's, you know, he's kind of, I think he's drawing attention to the problem of, you know, that Weber correctly identifies a problem with modernity, but a problem also with his theory, that he's unable to ground or legitimize, ground these questions in truth. That it's kind of famously, you know, it's the fight that happens under the empty sky.
Is that a Weber line?
Yeah, it's not complete. It's something like we carry our idols into battle beneath an empty sky, meaning it's, you know, there's no, it's been drained of of meaning. Authority and the gods and the meaning. Yeah.
No, that's good. I mean, you know, and I think Carl Schmitt brings this even more explicitly to light because it becomes a kind of, I don't know if normative proposal, but we've seen this in the Reading Club last year where we discussed Carl Schmitt at the very beginning of the year, in which, you know, sovereign authority is grounded in the ability and the one who makes the exception, right? And I think then it becomes very clear what Habermas means in referring to decisionistic authority or decisionistic means, where you basically, through the act, it's a, you know, the deed, the act of the deed, the, help me out here, wait, the propaganda of the deed, is that what I was, that's what I'm looking for?
You're very,
I'm not sure, you've Habermas'd yourself.
No, I don't know, that's not the
you've
word.
You've Habermas'd yourself. You've taken a Schmidt. You've taken a Schmidt
all over this podcast.
All over the discourse and all over the pod.
Oh, dear. Anyway.
No, the arbitrary, you know.
Yeah,
decision
arbitrary decision instantiates
yeah,
the
it
order.
It kind of grounds, you know, the whole structure kind of is, you know, the bureaucracy is rational and orderly and efficient, and your Prussian civil servant will give you the right form when you turn up to the office. But there's nothing underpinning it all. Underpinning it all is just the arbitrary will of the sovereign. And so that's this kind of ultimately nihilistic and disenchanted vision of social order, which has no basis in truth, that Habermas is trying to overcome.
Yeah, I think there's something there about like that, like Schmitt is a kind of more spectacular version, right? It's the sovereign makes the decision, and this is kind of like everybody's watching, and then it's like, oh my god, I can't believe the sovereign just made that decision, that's incredible, oh, you changed everything. And but for Habermas, for Weber, it's more like, okay, well, yeah, you have this, there's still nothing behind it, but it's like much more boring and bureaucratic. But I guess that's the ultimately what they share. And Habermas says, well, there's an alternative position, which I saw him as attributing to this Winckelmann, who I have to admit I've never heard of. I don't know if either of you have. Maybe I'm missing out on the
Winckelmann.
The Winckelmannites in amongst our listeners can upbraid us for this.
We now have. So Alex has taken a Schmidt on the podcast, and George has taken out a Winckel. Yeah. listeners, remember you're paying for this content.
Yeah. Jesus. Apologies for. Anyway,
yeah, I think there was a serious point here before I was rudely interrupted there. So that there's essentially what is required in addition to this to legality. Like you do, there is some rule following, but there has to also be, in order for legitimation to be achieved, there has to be some sort of general consensus that the law relates to justice and so on to truth. So essentially, Habermas is positing, to be crude about it, I would say, an additional requirement for legitimation is not just here are these rules,
right,
and here's the way that they're legitimated, either through this spectacular sovereign decision or this workaday bureaucratic rational legal authority, but you need this kind of general consensus, the Winckelmannite position.
Well, it's
faults, it's good. I mean, or not good, but I mean, for all his faults, you know, like the aspiration to avoid nihilism, you know, particularly given how deeply embedded it is into German social science, you know, and German political thought, it's, you know, it's the attempt at least is noble, even if the execution may be flawed.
Well, so what I was reaching for earlier, which actually connects this up, which is that, you know, in Faust, it's am Anfang war die Tat, you know, in the beginning was the deed, which is in contrast to the biblical, you know, at the beginning was the word, right? So it's like, Phil's, you can't see this, listener, but Phil's calling me a wanker for making that point. But the point is that, you know, if the order is instantiated by deed, it becomes decisionistic, right? It's will ultimately is determining, versus what something which is based on the word, at the beginning was the word, like in the biblical sense, is one which is based on truth and meaning, which instantiates the order. So I think that might be a kind of a dichotomy, though maybe that would be a dichotomy which we'd actually end up getting stuck on and might obscure things. I don't know.
No, just a couple of points on that. The first thing that I thought was, well, you know, isn't Faust composed of words? So actually the words come first, even in that example. And then I thought, no, that's just very facile. And then I thought, well, actually,
indeed,
didn't the Bible come first? So isn't actually the word first, because it was in the thing that was first in the earlier book? And then I thought, no, well, that's
material, you know, is the deed of Christians rather than the word of Christians, which maybe
then you get to the dialectical position that every word is actually a deed. Indeed. So the word and the deed are the same. So
let's crack on.
Yes. Yeah, this is just quite right. No. So I think we can just take stock a little bit so far. I mean, you know, let's boil it down.
Did you say habermasturbatory?
Good.
I should have done, but that itself is a deed proving the truth of the matter, because that is indeed habermasturbatory. To even say
right.
That.
I think I'm to be blamed for us losing track a little bit here. So to get us back on track, I think it is worth, you know, just in pretty broad brush terms summarizing that you have essentially, you know, Weber and Schmidt on one side. It, you know, essentially the detimation is arbitrary. It doesn't require truth. And then Habermas and Winkelmann on the other side, you know, that there is a general consensus of the relation of law to justice and to truth required for there to be legitimation and not just arbitrary power. Is it fair to say that, like, mapping this onto today, that you have the kind of the Habermas wants truth, and he's a kind of a truth guy. He's like a, you know, a gullible, credulous lib. And then you have the kind of the black-pilled arbitrary guys who are like, no, this is all, you know, the nihilists. And they're like, oh, actually, no, you're just a bit like, is this all a bit bait, isn't it? You know, come on, don't we really know what's going on? That it's you don't need legitimation. You just need ultimately more or less masked force.
Yeah, and indeed, maybe a position in between that, which would be the, well, it works, doesn't it? What's the problem? Right, the kind of pragmatic, even functionalist kind of approach, which is just like, you know,
I don't think there are any pragmatic functionalists left. I mean, does anybody actually say things work nowadays?
Well, that is obviously a fair point, but I think there's political defenders.
There's political defenders of the current order
who will say, like, you know, but we just maybe things are so strained that they hardly exist. But you know, I'm sure you'll find people in Australia or, you know, Finland who say this or something, you know.
From Australia to Finland. Yeah. I mean, they are both quite practically minded peoples, actually.
And that is a wide geographic swathe between the two.
Yeah, no, point taken. Anyhow, so that's if that's the kind of, I think, the starting point, he moves on to this chapter on the end of the individual, which I think has a pretty attention-grabbing title, but I found the argument a bit more elusive than I was hoping. I mean, you can make some very interesting cases for the end of the individual, why this might have happened, social, political, cultural forces, which either eliminate the precursors of individuality, whatever they may be, or homogenize people to the extent that there's no difference between A, B, and C. But that's not exactly the way that Habermas, of course, proceeds. It's a bit more through systems and all this sort of thing. So Habermas starts off by saying that the fundamental function of world maintaining interpretive systems, you can hear the Habermasian ring in what I'm saying there probably, is the avoidance of chaos, you know, but fair enough. But then after a bit of a discussion on how democracy no longer has the goal of rationalizing authority through the, you know, participation of citizens in will formation, which I think is, you know, something which we've discussed on this podcast in slightly different terms, but rather facilitating compromises between elites. He then concludes that the end of the individual can be found in the end of a logic of social reproduction that is based on norms that admit of truth. So kind of a few twists and turns in the way that he says that, but what do we make of this? I mean, is he right that this is that we have reached the end of the individual, and does he have the process for it right?
I don't know if I can answer that question even directly, but I mean, it is interesting that he, you know, is kind of engaging with the argument in, you know, his Frankfurt School colleagues, the dialectic of enlightenment, of kind of the eclipse of the individual, eclipse of individual liberty, as a, you know, the sort of dark side of the enlightenment. and you, I don't know whether how he's trying to obviously find a way to rescue rationality and the rational individual through his engagement in discourse ethics, will formation, etc. That you might like ground legitimately a social order in something true and meaningful and democratic and universal. And you know, I think that's an important and essential and valuable, essential, necessary, whatever project. But I think, you know, the tell is sometimes, at least for me reading this, is that like, I'm not sure if I can find a positive answer, positive in the sense of like good, to if world maintaining interpretive systems today belong irretrievably to the past, then what fulfills the moral practical task of constituting ego and group identity? And I think this
Which page are you talking about?
So Alex? This is on page 120 towards the bottom of it, the last paragraph of page 120. If world-maintaining interpretive systems today belong irretrievably to the past, then what fulfills the moral practical task of constituting ego and group identity? And it's true that, like, are there any world-maintaining interpretive systems today? I mean, in the way that kind of old-time religion did, or indeed maybe for a while that kind of socialism did, you know, maybe nationalism, but, you know, there's the question of, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure even if nationalist ideologies can fulfill that.
Habermas opted for human rights, right? I mean, that's also important that he doesn't discuss this here.
I'm not sure if that was at this stage or longer down the road, you know, if in the early 70s he had adopted that position. But maybe we can leave that maybe to the fourth, you know, like next month's episode.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this was a brilliant chapter, you know, like for a number of reasons. I mean, from kind of restating basic positions, I mean, Hegelian positions, I think, perhaps earlier, you know, but on the top of page 1118, the unity of the person requires the unity-enhancing perspective of a life world that guarantees order and has both cognitive and moral practical significance. Yeah. So the intermeshing of individuality with social order and their interdependence, in fact, of both. I mean, it's a brilliant, you know, kind of it just undercuts or cuts the ground away from all these tedious debates that counterpose individualism to collectivism and that we just simply, you know, continuously kind of spin around in ordinary kind of everyday kind of political debate, you know.
And which gets parlayed into state versus market politics as well.
Yeah, exactly. Those tedious questions. You know, so that's brilliant. And also then the way he flips it, you know, so he flips the kind of the, when he kind of makes the point about the decay of democratic theory. I remember when I read this for the first time, because I'd read kind of extracts of Legitimation Crisis as an undergraduate, but not the whole essay. And so I read the whole essay more recently before we came to do it for the pod. And when I read this section, I was, on the one hand, kind of I was impressed by its kind of gusto, but also saddened, I suppose. There's no better word, but saddened by realizing just how long, you know, literally decades into the 20th, deep into the 20th century in the past, we were still having these debates. But he makes this point, what you quoted, George, about the, you know, conventionally or one view of democracy is that it drowns the individual into kind of meaninglessness. Whereas here he makes a very powerful case that participation in collective will formation is a crucial precondition of preserving individuality. Right. And he just turns the tables on all those boring kind of technocratic understandings of democracy on page 123. The generalizable interest of all individuals, self-determination and participation. And instead, he turns democracy into prosperity without freedom. So democracy in kind of the hands of people like Martin Lipset and you know, the result of like the critiques developed by Joseph Schumpeter and so on that took the consumerist view of democracy. What this happens then, it's no longer tied to, but this is Habermas talking now, democracy is no longer tied to political equality in the sense of an equal distribution of political power. Political equality now means only the formal right to equal opportunity of access to power. Democracy no longer has the goal of rationalizing authority, and this is the quote that George gave earlier, rationalizing authority through the participation of citizens in discursive processes of will formation. That's the bottom of page 123. Anyway, yeah, excellent. You know, I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, I guess you could maybe draw out a kind of a point about the way that Habermas expresses himself, that even when he tries to put as much like systems theory stuff around it, some of the basic kind of dialectical insights still mean that it is pretty good stuff. I mean, I would boil this like whole chapter down to that fundamental insight that he puts forward, or that he builds on, which is the end of the individual and the end of collectivity, or the end of something which is larger than the individual. That's the process, those two things being dialectically linked, not that the individual is kind of undermined by individual level things, if that makes sense, that there is a connection between the subject and the part and the whole, if you will. I mean, I think what he has as these kind of collectivities or these wholes or these kind of things are universalistic linguistic ethics, which is not exactly what I would focus on. But I think that kind of way that he is able to kind of, you know, connect the individual and the something larger than the individual as the requirement for the production of individuality. Yeah, it's pretty good stuff. It's pretty good stuff. But I think it's almost, when I said I found the argument elusive, it's almost the way that he's expressing it kind of, I think, dilutes a little bit that fundamental insight.
So maybe this is an opportunity, you know, looking at this chapter 4 of The End of the Individual, which again is the one which is more kind of graspable, I think. And it might be worth looking at three kind of options that Habermas sets out. And we've already hinted at them a little bit, specifically with what Phil was talking about. Let me just try to set this up. So this is on page 122, if you're following along. He starts off that the fact that the developmental logic of worldviews does not exclude the continuance of a mode of socialization related to truth may be comforting. Nevertheless, the steering imperatives of highly complex societies could necessitate disconnecting the formation of motives from norms capable of justification and setting aside, as it were, the detached superstructure of normative structure. So this is basically like saying, you know, we can have justificationless motivation. You have like kind of people's motivation is completely separate from the governing of society, right? And then if this happened, legitimation problems per se would cease to exist. A number of reflections from the history of ideas speak for this tendency, and I'd like to draw attention to them. So he goes on to do this. Just before I go on to list the three, I think it might be, what I think he's getting at is something that we can already glimpse more clearly today, which is that, you know, culture effectively provides meaning and motivation in kind of various fragmented subcultures or whatever, whereas the running of society continues on completely separately. And if we don't even care about politics, you know, we just live in our like little sub world, the legitimation no longer becomes a problem because we're not asking things of the state, right? This is a vision in some ways of the end of politics. Correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, but he then gives three examples, A, B, and C. One, he identifies with Nietzsche, which it's an idea that of cynicism, which has been around for over a century, and where he cites Nietzsche that every belief, every taking for true is necessarily false because there is no true world. So basically, you know, the fuck it, just do it, will is all that matters kind of solution, which we already hinted at. Anyone who still discusses the admissibility of truth in practical questions is at best old-fashioned. They're kind of Habermas satirizing this, the kind of Nietzschean cynical nihilistic view. You care about truth? What a loser you are. You know, how old-fashioned. That's one approach. The other approach is what he calls the elite theory of domination, which identifies with Mosca, Pareto, and Michels, but also is identified with authors that Phil has already mentioned, Kornhauser, Lipset, Truman, and Ralph Dahrendorf. Democracy in this view is no longer determined by the content of a form of life that takes into account the generalizable interest of all individuals. It counts now only as a method for selecting leaders and the accoutrements of leadership. Arguably where we are now with post-democracy, you know, democracy is just a way of filtering up leaders. It's a job interview, you know, as kind of technocrats love to portray it as. And democracy is really just a means of making sure that no elite faction gains total control of the state. This is why elites like democracy. Elites like democracy not because they believe in popular power, but because they don't want any alternative faction gaining total control of the state. It means that they still have access to the state, have means of negotiation, have ways of balancing things out, and that ultimately they can lobby their representatives and executives and other elements of the state, non-representative elements of the state, and still get their, you know, have their interests seen to. That's why elites like democracy. And that's kind of one of the other kind of responses to this. And then the third one, which is item C on page 124, is one that I don't fully understand. And I would be interested if you can you can help me out with this. He starts off by saying, in all the many symptoms of a destruction of practical reason to be found in the history of ideas, there is expressed a change of position in bourgeois consciousness, which allows of different interpretations. And he goes on to kind of explain what some of these are, but ultimately it can be formulated in the thesis, the end of the individual. And this, I guess, would be the darkest conclusions of the dialectic of enlightenment by Horkheimer and Adorno, in which the response to the kind of complete sundering of political system from normative structures and thereby meaning that legitimation no longer matters anymore, is a world in which the individual has ceased to exist, and we're ultimately kind of endlessly manipulable. And again, it's an end of politics sort of vision. So if I'm summing up, apologies for going on so long, if I've understood this section correctly, he's basically looking at three different ways that you have an end of politics. One is just the Nietzschean answer of emphasis on will, on power, because nothing is really true. The other one is elite democracy, or post-democracy as it's called, where the state is open only to elite interests and is not a vehicle for popular participation in any way. And the third is one of this sort of a tragic view of the end of individual, the end of the individual, where the rational subject no longer exists and is no longer constitutive of society and politics. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I read the third one as, you know, drawing on dialectic enlightenment. It's not so much that the rational subject doesn't exist, but that reason has, you know, it's a Weberian point, I would say, that reason has kind of become completely detached from this like relationship between like means and ends, and just has completely become means. So there is no possibility of politics, because reason is so all encompassing and dominating that you have, you know, things like the Holocaust, which is on one sense rational, they say in dialectic enlightenment, because it's just a triumph of reason, it's a triumph of administration, it's a triumph of, you know, don't edit this out of context, because obviously, you know, this is they mean this in a very specific way, that the Holocaust is the pinnacle of reason in one sense, because it's just completely, the ends don't matter at all, yeah. But the instrumentality has reached its pinnacle, and there's no place for the subject. There's no place for politics in that context, because it's so totalizing, and that's, you know, ultimately something they attribute to the Enlightenment, and even back further than that to Ulysses, if I remember that book correctly. It's quite a provocative thesis, obviously, but I think that's how he's taking it, that it's almost like the triumph of the bourgeois consciousness leads to its own undoing. It's very bleak, though, because it's like there's no counter tendency to break free of that, and so we're left with a utterly administered post-political society, not even in a kind of technocratic way, but in a kind of purely and fully rational way.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, no, that clarifies what I was trying to get at much better than, you know, I think that is exactly the right answer. I forgot that there's actually an item D. There's a fourth one, which is on page 128. One can get so lost in kind of the arguments here that one loses track even of the sequence of items that Habermas has set out. But item D starts off, and this is a little bit kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say funny, but it's slightly ironic. Until now, no one has succeeded in extracting the thesis of the end of the individual from the domain of the malaise and self-experience of intellectuals and made it accessible to empirical test, i.e., you know, so all this stuff about dialectic of enlightenment, instrumental rationality triumphing, like, maybe that's true, Habermas is saying, but no one's able really to test it out, because maybe it's just Adorno feeling really kind of like glum. Maybe that's what it's about. That's what Habermas is saying there.
Yeah, I think that's Adorno 1, Habermas 0. Like, I mean, it's such a ridiculous claim at one level, you know, like, I mean, where, you know, like, what would count as an empirical test of a proposition like that, you know?
Well, yeah.
You could have a survey and you could ask enough people, are you an individual? And if they say no, then no individuals.
I'm not sure that would prove the point.
At the risk of kind of commandeering what is George's ship here, I know that we're going to discuss this question about the student protest where he makes this aside. And this is the point at which he does it under item D. And this is one of the other kind of possibilities for a world where justification doesn't matter, legitimation doesn't matter, right? So if you continue down to the bottom of 128, he raises this idea of inauthenticity. A relationship, institution, or society is inauthentic if it provides the appearance of responsiveness while the underlying condition is alienating. And this is maybe...
But that's Habermas quoting Etzioni, right?
It is Habermas quoting Etzioni, but this is the... You know, Habermas is setting out these kind of four items, and that's one of them. I think that kind of expresses it. So why don't you take it away from there, George?
Yeah, no, I think it's time to put down the mutiny, and for the captain, well, for this episode is me, to reestablish their place at the rudder of the good ship Bunga. Anyway, yeah, so I did want to pick up on this point, that Habermas mentions kind of almost in passing, the student protests of previous years. So it's kind of an airy phrase. And he has this as an example of how, and this to quote, social conflicts can be shifted to the level of psychic problems, that they can be charged to individuals as private matters, and conversely, that, quote, mental conflicts that are repoliticized as protests can be shunted aside, made into problems that can be administratively treated and institutionalized as proof of the extended scope of tolerance. So, touching on some kind of Marcusean, if that's the right word, themes there. Is he right in his characterization of student protests? I think it's, you know, it's quite interesting, like, that he sort of, you know, we're talking about legitimation problems and their logic and all this sort of thing. And this is one of his examples, perhaps. People were crying out earlier for examples. How do you like this one?
Yeah, it's also interesting because famously it was the thing, or supposedly it was the thing, in the kind of historical recounting of the Frankfurt School, on which Habermas and Adorno disagreed. Adorno was skeptical of Habermas because Habermas was supposedly more sympathetic to the student protesters than Adorno was. And here Habermas is kind of distancing himself from them, or seems to be, at least. I mean, that's the way I read it. And also, you know, again, in kind of reading this, it just struck me like, hey, it's a point that's been made, but I suppose I always thought of it as a more recent point, the idea that 1968 was kind of a retreat from politics into the psyche. And here you have Habermas kind of making it, you know, kind of very close to the student protests themselves.
Yeah, like that most 4 years on from 68. Probably, 3 years, really.
When I encountered that point, it was kind of in, you know, I don't know, people like, I'm trying to think now, kind of, you know, old 68ers kind of at the end of the 20th century or the early 21st century kind of looking back and almost by way of kind of, you know, kind of long-term reflection on what 68 was about, making those kinds of points, like Tony Judt's kind of histories and so on. And to see it made here in the early 1970s just reminded me how much these kinds of debates have been spinning ground for so long.
Also how Habermas, you know, did see some things quite clearly, I guess. Even, you know, relatively close to the time. To take it back to Adorno, though, who's a thinker who I'm not necessarily always fully positive about. Apologies to any Adornians listening, but there's an excellent Adorno quote which I do want to read at length, just because I think it's excellent. So Adorno remarks, it is still too optimistic to think that the individual is being altogether liquidated. If only it were true that in his conclusive negation, in the abolition of monads through solidarity, there was embedded at the same time the salvation of the individual being that would become a particular precisely only in its relation to the general. The present state of affairs is far removed from this. The disaster transpires not as the radical extinction of what has been, but because what has been historically condemned is being dragged along, dead, neutralized, powerless, and pulls ignominiously downwards. In the midst of standardized and administered human units, the individual lives on. He is even placed under the protection and gains monopoly value. But he is in truth merely the function of his own uniqueness, a showpiece like the deformed who were stared at with astonishment and mocked by children. Since he no longer leads an independent economic existence, his character falls into contradiction with his objective social role. Precisely for the sake of this contradiction, he is sheltered in a nature preserve, enjoyed in leisurely contemplation. So
it's a brilliant quote.
It is good, isn't it?
That from Minima Moralia.
There's no escape, you know, there is no escape. You can't even, you know, that at least the kind of extinction of the individual would kind of be a solution, even if a terrible and, one that was not longed for. But Adorno kind of blocks off that route. You know, like we're still bound up with the contradictions of the legacy of individuality preserved in systems that recreate them.
I just think that idea of dragged along, dead, neutralized, powerless, and not a definitive negation that allows something to replace it. There's a lot that hits me where I live, not necessarily with relation to the individual, but as a kind of general characterization of
it
many
hits
things.
You in your winkle.
And it would also jab or hits at both those who would one-sidedly defend society against the individual, as well as those who would one-sidedly defend the individual, like libertarians might, against society. You know, it's like now we're left with no individual and no society, whereas, you know, before there was more society and more individual, which, you know, again, putting it in really dumb terms, but, you know, kind of refer back to what Bill said earlier.
It's not quite even that. It's not that there's no individual and no society.
No, it's right. It's not
that you have both, but not the conditions for either. Not to get too like ooh la la about it, but that's essentially the conditions for persistence aren't there, but things still persist, so it's like it's all effed up, dude. I just wanted to highlight that because I sometimes am not too positive towards Adorno, but got to take your hat off to him on that occasion.
How do we, like, it might be worth, like, just a question kind of off the top of my head, you know, if the individual is kind of half dead, right, kind of being dragged along, probably a lot of the political conflicts and kind of culture wars as well that we see today can be thought of in that light, in the sense of an individual which still sort of exists and might rebel in defense of its individuality, but without being able to take responsibility for itself. So you have this sort of prickliness of like, how dare you judge me? You can't judge me. You can't tell me what to do, or you can't, of course, the state can tell you what to do. That's accepted. But, you know, you person on social media can't tell me that my way of living, my lifestyle is wrong. So there's a sort of defense of an individuality there, you know, which retains at the same time as being completely a governable subject, you know, because the state will tell you, like, you know, wear your mask and, you know, whatever, to do, pick a stupid COVIDian example, but, you know, you'll be like, yeah, I'll go along with this, right? Or, like, you know, you have to accept all sorts of forms of security state invasions of privacy and whatever, and so that old individuality is gone, at the same time as there's a kind of prickliness of a defensive individuality on a different terrain. I don't know if I'm kind of talking, you know, kind of mixing up different things.
No,
here, but
it's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure we can answer it in the scope of a podcast about, like, the final section of Habermas's book. But it's a good question. You know, how far kind of you could analyze the prism of all of this malaise, the malaise of contemporary politics through these, through the kind of the dead weight of these historical forms that are dragged along. And yet, you know, and so persist despite the fact that they're not being actively recreated.
Yeah, I mean, hearing you say that, Alex, kind of did make me think about, like, there's a, you know, displacement almost. So you can't resolve the conflict between the individual and society to produce any meaning by either one pole or the other or their interaction. So you just displace it onto culture. And so I'm not talking about culture wars. I guess it's more like, you know, that's where people, it's not, we talked about this earlier, and it's not like the running of society does not legitimate it or validate, not even validate's the right word, but not produce the conditions for the individual. So you've got to like define yourself by your cultural taste or whatever. But, you know, yeah, as Phil said, this, that's probably, I'm not even going to say let's do that next episode, because that would just
I think
a solution to the problem of the individual next episode.
No, I don't mean that, but just in terms of like finding the mediating links between this question of the individual and the question of legitimation, that might be something worth exploring next episode. Well, anyway, we'll put a pin in that. I'll make a note and come back to it.
Make a note. So I've already touched on this. I guess a kind of another kind of general or thematic question, just to kind of pick out a particularly interesting little bit that Habermas talks about in inauthenticity and alienation. So he has this discussion about how alienation might have been replaced by inauthenticity. What does he mean? And do we buy this?
Yeah, so there's this intriguing idea that, I mean, I think people have, probably listeners have encountered this idea of the politics of politics of authenticity, of a drive for authenticity. I mean, all the debate around cultural appropriation is all premised on a notion of authenticity, right? So it's a recurring trope. I mean, it's a recurring trope, you know, since the Romantics, but which returns again, you know, in the Romantic revolt of the 1960s and in the period after, which is, of course, what Habermas is referring to. And it's interesting that he says, quoting Amitai Etzioni, the sociologist, a relationship, institution, or society is inauthentic if it provides the appearance of responsiveness while the underlying condition is alienating. So that's kind of already an interesting idea. So like it's inauthentic if it appears to be responsive. It appears like, hey, I care about you or I respond to you, but actually it's completely alienating. And he relates this to the kind of the student protests. And how you know, there that was also a kind of revolt against inauthenticity. Now there's this other point, and I'm trying to tie them together, so help me out, guys. This little jab, which is great, which he talks about the student protests and about how the degree of tolerance on the part of, and this is the Marcusean point, but kind of in some sense the degree of tolerance from the top down has increased. So the headlines already report on university strikes and citizens' initiatives, regretfully adding, without incident, which is to say repression was expected and even, one could argue, to a certain extent desired as a way of giving meaning to the protest and to revolt and to show that the world was responsive. Hey, I'm making this demand of you, and if you don't, and you should repress me. If you don't repress me, then are you not even responsive at all to me? Are you not paying attention? And that's a kind of an idea which I think recurs through a lot of contemporary protests too, where so much gets focused and refocused around police and repression of the police. And that's where a lot of protest gains meaning today, unfortunately. And we can think about that through, you know, the Arab Spring, the occupation of squares and so on. Anyway, how does that relate to the question of alienation now being inauthenticity rather than the old form of alienation?
So he's saying, I think, so what? The students, 68, they're protesting against inauthenticity. So their provocations are attempted to draw out the kind of
the hard hand of the state, basically, yeah.
No, I don't think, so he's not quite saying that, because he's saying they're trying to expose inauthenticity. So, the lack of responsiveness is not the lack of authenticity, right? That's, I think it's, there's layers to the claim, right? So, you know, they seek to point out inauthenticity, but they don't get the response that they expected. I mean, isn't that the point?
I don't know. I guess responsiveness has a slightly different meaning today. Like, it's like, do you want a government to be responsive? It's almost like this. You said we did, like, we're responsive to your concerns. It definitely means the opposite today.
Look, he says
that is the inauthenic way.
It's been the essential management impulse. of dissent. Yeah, sorry.
The essential impulse is directed against the anticipated strategies of absorption. So like the, you know, the provocations of the 1960s, they're intended to avoid being absorbed by the system, right? These are supposed to be undermined, i.e. strategies of absorption are supposed to be undermined by imaginative provocations. I don't know, like situationist stuff or theater in the street or I don't know, whatever you want. By and large, this has not succeeded. The degree of tolerance has increased. So I think the point is there, right, that the that this, what they're trying to do is to, it's not that the inauthenticity is the fact that the state doesn't crush them. They're trying to expose inauthenticity and they fail to do so, right? So it's kind of, there's more to it than simply the fact that the absence of repression is not demonstration of inauthenticity. The students are trying to kind of draw attention to, certain kinds of things, but it simply fails. It falls flat.
Maybe this is something to return to in the next episode as well, because there's a lot. Yeah. There's something here that's quite interesting to explore, but I'm finding myself interpreting it in opposite ways, you know, simultaneously, which sounds like dialectics, but it isn't. It's confusion. so maybe to one to return to.
No, I think I think we can put this in the to come back to pile if we have one. No, because I think it is an important bit of political context, right? The Habermas is, you know, we've talked about this quite a few times, but the context of 68 as a, like, it's inescapable when you're talking about legitimation problems in the early 70s. And so I think we should, and also given what we said before about the paucity of examples, we should return to this. And it's always interesting to compare 68 to today as well. So there's that to be gained as well. Well, that's all we have time for on part three then. And that's the end of the book. There is no the end at the end of the book, which is,
well, there is one very short kind of the end, which I think is maybe a little bit of a cop out, where he basically says, like, you know, if we don't try to find a kind of rational, meaningful basis for things, you know, that we basically saying we need to continue the struggle against the stabilization of a nature-like system over the heads of its citizens. Right. So that's good. We need to fight against this alienating system, because the price of not doing so will be the loss of old European human dignity. So, you know, I think ultimately he is trying to ground this idea of truth in his kind of discourse ethics and rational will formation. But what underlies that ultimately, he kind of goes, well, you know, that's just human dignity. I'm not sure how convincing that is.
It's not surprising that his ultimate kind of grounding is in dignity, because that's the basis of I guess an ethics of communication. You have to both recognize and respect your interlocutor, otherwise you can't have, but I, you can't but have that
and but specifically old European human dignity. And of course this is a reference to like a debate that he has with Luhmann earlier, who kind of is critical of this idea of like, oh, you know, the individual subject, rational individual subject, which we should care about. Oh, that's just old European kind of concerns. Or, you know, actually, no, specifically in relation to kind of class politics. But nevertheless, the kind of, you know, if we can think of kind of classical Marxism, its concerns, Luhmann is just kind of going, oh, that's just old European crap. We don't need to care about that anymore. We need just like rational systems that work above people. Who cares?
Yeah, we have new European crap now. New European dignity. So
yeah,
that's what we've got. I think there's a lot to talk about in this book, to kind of draw it all together, consider the political context, and we've done that obviously a little bit throughout, but I think it's definitely worth returning to it as a whole and drawing out some of those themes and answering some of the bigger questions that we couldn't answer by reference to one or two bits of chapters or parts. So onwards and upwards for good shit bunga. We're gonna ride on the waves of ideas. Or the ship is going to crest the waves of ideas.
Anyway, we'll be back next month. Let us know what you thought of this. We've tried to draw out kind of the most salient points. If there's other elements which you think we've missed and you think actually there's this really important thing in systems theory, let us know. But also, if you think that there's an important application of these ideas to today that we should be discussing, we're going to do that in episode 4. That's what we intend to do. If you have any readings that you think, actually, hey, there's this one guy who discusses a legitimation crisis in contemporary times and go, you guys need to read this, let's do that. We have some things in mind that we want to discuss, but if you want to throw other things on the pile, please do so, because I think there's a lot of different directions we could take this. It's the book itself is at a very high level of abstraction. It tries to contain a load of stuff, but is also quite specific to its time, times which are different to today's. So lots that we could potentially explore. So let us know. We want to hear what you thought. We'll be back with you next time. And maybe just a reminder, if you want to be looking forward, if you're new to us and you're new to the Reading Club, that we're going to be discussing probably something a little bit more tangible next time. We'll be discussing, well, globalization, I guess. Adam Smith in Beijing by the Italian political economist Giovanni Arrighi. That'll be in the kind of last 3 months of the year. So looking forward to doing that. And we'll see you next time. Catch you later. Bye-bye.